Good afternoon. The mic was on, Zach the engineer. My headphones were not. Now everything's fine. Hey, guess what? It's Vox Pop. It's 2 o'clock-ish. It's Thursday. I'm Ray Graff. Off to a slow start, but we'll finish strong because it's the Science Forum. Barb Brabets and Ed Stander join us to field your scientific questions if you have one. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. We have our headphone level set. We have everything ready to go. All you got to do is call. It's the Science Forum. It begins after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today it's the Science Forum, and our experts are ready to answer all of your science curiosities. On the line today, Barbara Brabets and Ed Stander, both from SUNY Cobleskill. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org. And that's a good way to do it, but also calling is a good way to do it. 800-348-2551 is our number. Barbara Brabets, welcome back.
Why, thanks, Ray. And glad to be back.
For those who have never heard this show, your areas of expertise are?
I'm a biochemist, so I lay claim to biology and chemistry.
All right, fair enough. And Ed Stander, how are you, sir?
I'm okay, I think.
All right, and school is underway for you guys?
Not about yet. Ten days.
Ten days to go? So you're relaxing?
Yeah, February 1st.
Well, that's good. Well, I hope things go well in the coming semester. Ed, what is your area of expertise for those who have not heard this program?
Geology, astronomy, environmental science, anything that Barbara can't answer.
Okay.
Which is not very much,
no,
by the way.
It's very true. We'll start out with, but before we go to the email, we have a good question here, and I'll throw it your way, but is there anything on the science news front that either of you would like to bring up?
Well, if I could just put a plug in for higher education for a moment.
Certainly.
With vaccines rolling out, and hopefully we'll be over the hump of COVID soon, the semester is starting February 1st, and I think my admissions department would, be happy to have me say that we are still looking for either transfers or new students to join SUNY Cobleskill. It's an easy commute from the Capital Region. In fact, Ed lives in Del Mar and commutes in all the time.
That's a sizable commute there, Ed. This question is actually about the COVID. It came in from Bill before the show started. We'll start with you, Barbara. How often should people be washing outerwear, like winter jackets and hats, during the pandemic? And that's from Bill. Hearing nothing? Did we lose you both?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. One of you could answer it, I suppose.
Barb, you want to take it?
I think we lost Barb.
Lost Barb.
How about you, Ed? What do you think?
Well, generally speaking, there's a sort of a consensus developing about how long the virus can stay on clothes. It's usually about 7 to 9 days maximum. It depends on the material. But basically, the real question is there enough COVID on the clothes to make a difference? And that's something which has to be answered still. Because there's a load requirement. You have to have a certain amount of it come into your system so that your body can see it and attack it. So it's, for my own work, I'm not worried too much about it because I think that the amount that you would actually have on your clothes is too small to be a problem.
SUNY Cobleskill actually did very well so far. We'll knock wood here with regard to the COVID. You guys have run a tight ship over there.
Yeah, we do pooling, 10 students or 10 faculty at a time. And if one of the if the pool comes out,
I'm back.
then we go from there.
All right. As we all heard, Barbara's back. What happened?
Well, I'm not really sure. My fingers were not pressing on the button. So
okay. Well, fair enough.
I think the internet gods just said no way.
Okay.
You know what I think it was? I think it's because Ed said anything that Barbara can't answer, and they took it very literally, and Barbara couldn't answer because she couldn't talk.
Well, very true. Well, let's go to the phones.
That's an interesting idea.
800-348-2551 is the number on the Science Forum. Jim is in Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
I have an old Zenith picture tube TV, and even when it's off, it's still plugged in, and I'm getting pumping noise and no picture, and it's probably an electrical surge in there somewhere, but I just wonder if you guys knew it might be.
Did you say a thumping noise?
Yeah, thumping.
All right.
Like power surge going through it.
Okay.
You know, the alternating current.
Gotcha. Ed?
How old is the television? Is it a tube television? Or
probably 20 years or so.
Yeah, well, if it's a tube, it could be just coming out of from the tubes. If it's not, there's really no... I can't see any reason why it would be start thumping. Capacitors don't generally thump. They generally burn out rather than thump.
They do what?
I'm just...
Go on.
Somebody go.
Barb?
I'll go. I just had a question as to when we switched over to fully digital signal, what the use of an old television is.
Ah, all right.
I don't know. This happened, first started happening about a year ago.
So you're still using the TV, or were still using the TV. You're hearing a thumping noise.
I was, yeah. Now it's just holding up the new... Okay. 60-inch deal.
Yeah. You know, with old TVs, I remember, and old radios, I remember an old Philco radio that when the capacitors went, it would start to hum, but that was when it was on. And then
right.
You knew the capacitors were going. The thumping, I mean, have you looked inside, Jim? Maybe there's a rodent in there or something.
No, I did try to look inside the last year, but I couldn't find anything out of normal.
Okay, well, keep us posted on that one. Jim, thank you for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. It's the Science Forum with Barbara Brabets and Ed Stander. And Dan is in Kingston. Dan, go ahead.
Hi.
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 Yeah, thanks for being there. I'm an old tube guy. For one thing, but I'm a you know, at home do it yourself scientist guy with no degree.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since I was a kid and read my first biography of Nikola Tesla, I got interested in free energy systems, electronics, and gravity. And I've got a device. Hold on, Tony, I'm on the phone. I'm on the phone.
Okay, now.
Calm down.
All right, everything's fine.
I've been playing with pendulums. So I have this very heavy iron disc. And I took the iron disc and I use it as a pendulum.
Right.
And its axis is flat, so it's like a disc. Like a flying saucer kind of shape. And on that, I put magnets.
Yeah.
Coming out and then in different arrays.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I have a base centered on it. I have a central base that's directly in line with the pendulum line.
All right.
And then I spin it and I swing it. Swing it as straight as I can, and it takes on an oval orbit.
Okay.
Okay, as it goes by. And I can lower it. It will never really, it'll spin for an incredible length of time. Now, I'll do it without the magnets involved and spin and swing it as much as I can. I'm not in a laboratory situation. I can't do it exactly. But I do it again, and the decay is much more rapid.
Hmm.
So what I'm getting is from the attraction and repulsion of the magnetism,
right,
I'm getting a prolonged pendulous swing.
Okay.
Now, I felt that I could, yes.
Go ahead, Ed.
No, what I was just wondering is, are you swinging as a pendulum and spinning it at the same time?
No.
Just swinging
no,
it?
No, my only energy I'm putting in is raising it
and
to a point and releasing it.
Okay.
So I'm putting in that amount of energy, and I'm receiving, it seems like I'm getting more back.
I don't know, Ed.
Well, my guess is, what is the base made out of? You said there's a base below
iron.
Yeah. So what you're getting is an interaction of the magnets with the iron base, and they're repelling and attracting.
Yeah.
So it's the energy from the magnets that's keeping it going.
Right.
Okay.
If I did a copper winding on one or both of those and did the same thing, wouldn't I generate a current?
Well, you generate a magnetic current, yes.
Huh.
Not an electrical current.
No, not necessarily. Not unless, let's see. Yeah, not unless the iron base was a magnet as well. If the iron base was magnetic, then as you go past the magnetic field, then you'd start getting a current in the wires.
Okay.
Right, because all a motor all Tesla's motor is a rotating magnetic field.
Correct.
Well, that's all an alternator is, too, to that extent.
Dan, we have to take a break here. That's a very interesting call, but we do have to do some underwriting here. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. It's a science forum. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum with Ray Graff, 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets and Ed Stander from SUNY Cobleskill join us today. And Barbara, this is not fair to you, but this is a COVID question, and this is closer to your area of expertise, so I'll throw it your way. This one came in from Reed, and the subject heading is, can you spread after vaccination? Can you still carry and spread COVID once you've been vaccinated? My wife is vaccinated, wants to visit her mom in Vermont after her knee surgery. Her mom will have been vaccinated by then. However, the rest of us have not been vaccinated. What do you think, Barb?
So after the vaccination protocols right now are two shots, 28 days apart. If you are 4 weeks out from the second shot, then you have a 95% chance of being covered. In fact, if you go to eight weeks out from that second shot, it goes up just a hair, but you get a little bit more protection. It's not that, and it's not that more individuals become protected between the fourth and the eighth week. It's that your protection inside your body increases because of your immune system response from that fourth to eighth week. There is a 5% chance that you're not protected. And that means 5 people out of 100 still can contract COVID through community acquisition, through being not socially distant or being near someone who has COVID. You cannot get COVID from the COVID vaccine. It is like trying to say I have a dictionary in me that I'm going to pass on to someone else when you're only going to get a paragraph of information. Only a very small piece of the genetic code of COVID is being put into you, and it's not even DNA that's being put into you. It's kind of the Xerox copy of that. It's RNA. And so there's no way that the vaccine itself can transmit COVID to someone else. So if someone were to get a vaccine, stay socially distant, and then go visit their mother, they would not be bringing COVID to their mother. Mm. If you have the vaccine and then still have exposure, right, there is a chance that you could bring that to your mother, albeit very small.
And there are a number of people who have contracted COVID after receiving the vaccine, provided that they contracted it within 5 or 10 days of having the first shot. So you don't get full coverage at the first shot in any case.
All right, like with all other biological controls, if you use the controls too close to the actual interaction that could contaminate you, then you're not going to be protected. Think birth control. You can't take your birth control pills after or just before an encounter. You have to have a therapeutic level in your body in order to prevent conception. Same idea with COVID. It needs time to take it has to get a firm grip in your body with your immune system before you're fully immune.
It's the Science Forum with Ed Stander at Barbara Brabets. If you have a science question, give us a call at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Email voxpop@wamc.org. Shelley in Saugerties. Hello, Shelley in Saugerties. Hello, Shelley. Oh, Shelley, are you there?
Shelley, hello!
Oh, Shelley, oh, you waited and now you can't be on. Eric in Averill Park, you're on.
Hello? Yeah, you can hear me?
Yep, you bet.
Good. So my question is also about the COVID vaccine. I'm curious because the spread of it clearly has to do with density and all those things that, you know, people being around. But yet, beyond the obvious things like vaccinating the frontline workers, medical workers, all that good stuff, and very elderly, I haven't heard anything about vaccinating on a geographical density area, which seems to me to make a lot of sense. And I'm wondering if it's just something I don't understand. You know, these areas that have the most infections, it would seem that even if the person isn't that old, they can be spreading the vaccine in their area around two older people and two more people who might be compromised. So I just haven't heard anything about that. And that would seem to be, I don't know, fairer, if it made sense.
Well, it is an approach that has been used when we don't have it as an epidemic or a pandemic. So when you have a regional outbreak, then that's exactly what you do. And in fact, in the early part of this COVID-19 business, when we thought it was just in Wuhan, China, what they did is they tried to isolate Wuhan from the rest of mainland China by creating a travel ban to and from Wuhan. And that, because there was no vaccine, that in itself was supposed to dampen its spread. The problem is, in this modern day, we really do move around a lot. And even somebody, say, who, say, lives in New York City, say New York City were a hot spot, right? And we're going to vaccinate New York City and we're going to hope that it will contain the spread. And vaccinating 8 million people is not a trivial thing. Even at our fastest that we think that could happen, we're doing about 1 million people a day in this nation right now. At least that's what we're striving to do. It would take 2 shots. And those 2 shots, again, are about a month apart. The Pfizer vaccine, it's 3 weeks. The other one's 4 weeks, Moderna. But you've got that intermediate time where you've been vaccinated and you get that sense of security, but you aren't necessarily immune. And then you go to your second home in the Catskills because you want to get away from the hubbub in the city where everyone's sick, right? And then you spread it to the Catskills. So that's what we've seen, and that's what has happened. So they've taken a different approach, and that approach has been, let's hit the populations where we see the spread more, that is in the nursing homes and in community spread in the hospitals. Let's try to hit that first. Then let's hit our most vulnerable populations. That's a 1 out of 5 chance if you contract COVID and you're over 80 that you will die. It's a 1 out of 3,000 chance that if you contract COVID and you're under the age of 18 that you will die. So they've really tried to stop the deaths and to stop the spread in these select areas where death is a higher rate. So it's a consideration, and it's part of why there was a task force to come up with these recommendations to weigh all of these things.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Ed Stander and Barbara Brabets join us from SUNY Cobleskill. Jim in Gloversville, New York. Jim, you're up. You're on.
Yep, you know, the guy before who talked about a thumping out of his TV.
Yeah.
You know, a speaker will always thump, right? The coil in the speaker will cause the speaker to thump. But also, in the high voltage box on an older TV, the transformer might cause a thumping sound also.
Yeah, you make a point.
Depending on how old he has.
Yeah, he said it was about 10 years old. So I assume it was a tube set that was all transistorized. Say it again, Jim.
Usually, when I say a high voltage box, that's a tube, sort of a rectifier tube, right? And that can cause a thumping sound. Okay? The transformer in there can thump. And if it is, it's not a good sign for the transformer. I wouldn't put the set on if I were him.
All right. Well, thank you, Jim. We appreciate it. Go ahead.
Yeah, and we cut him off before I would say don't put your hands in the back of that set either, because those transformers still can retain energy even if it's unplugged.
Yep.
And people have, in the olden days, they have gotten electrical shocks that have not been trivial touching the insides of their TV.
Anybody I know who has worked on electronics has at least one story to tell of being zapped by capacitors that were not discharged or whatnot. So that is good advice. Don't mess around with it if you don't know what it is. However, I think he said the set was fairly recent. So I think, it was a picture tube, but I think that was the only tube in it. But anyway, that was a long time ago. Ed?
Yeah, everything's fine at my end.
Fine. Dave in Woodstock. Dave, you're on.
Yeah. How do we stop glass from fogging up with the masks on?
Oh, God, that's a great question. It's been driving me nuts for a year. Anybody have an idea?
You can use what I've used is a very, very mild dishwashing detergent, and you rub it on the inside, and then wash it out, and that keeps it from fogging for a very long time.
Did not work.
Oh, you tried that,
didn't work
for me.
Huh.
So a couple of things.
Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, a couple of things, because we use goggles all the time in the lab. So fogging up with masks is just kind of like the extension of what we've been dealing with for my whole career. You can buy an anti-fog spray. They work if you get a really good coverage. It can't be just like squirt, squirt, you're done. What you really need to do is mist it on, because what you're trying to do is create a thermal break from the inside of the goggle and the outside of the goggle. The condensation happens because there's a temperature change between inside the goggle and outside the goggle, and that glass or plastic surface is where that temperature change is taking place. So if you can create a thermal break on the inside and still maintain some sense of like visibility, that's the sweet spot for fog-free. What I've done is just try to direct the air elsewhere. Certain N95 masks will exhale the filtered air in different directions rather than the paper masks. The other thing I do in the lab is I tape my nose piece down, and that keeps the air from coming up between the cracks by the side of my nose and my glasses.
Oh,
because, you know, in the lab, I'm in the lab for like 27 hours of my work week, and I have to be able to see. I mean, I'm sure my students would prefer it if I can't, but it's best if I don't trip over the furniture.
That's more of
Ed, you go.
On. No, I was just going to say the basic reason that it fogs is because the surface tension of the fog material, the water that's getting in there, is forming small drops on the inside. And the reason why the detergent should work is because it decreases the surface tension. And what that does is it takes that water and spreads it out so that rather than being little drops of fog, it sort of covers the whole thing. And that's effectively the same thing as putting the mist on it. So my guess is that if you were to soak it for a bit so that you break down any oils that are on the surface with the detergent, it might work a lot better.
All right, Dave, thanks a lot. You know, it just occurs to me that really those sports goggles would probably be the best bet yet. They sort of fit like swimmer's goggles, but, you know, like if you play baseball or some sport, oftentimes you have these sports goggles that are prescription.
They work great.
Yeah, I bet.
They're very expensive. I mean, expensive relative to your $9 pair of goggles, but But they are terrific. In fact, some of our colleagues have switched to those because they don't want to touch their eyes in this time of COVID. And it's really hard to touch your eyes if you're wearing goggles.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. It is the Science Forum with Barbara Brabets and Ed Stander. Dave in Cambridge, New York. Dave.
Good afternoon. Hi. The combined field of expertise between our two experts is possibly helpful in this regard. By 2035, California is going to outlaw internal combustion, the sales of internal combustion-powered vehicles, which is relatively ducky. Electric cars are still more expensive despite the fact that the motor has only one moving part, but there it is. The controllers and the battery technology, there's other complications. I'm designing one. It's complicated. But my question that I'd like to put out is, what are we going to do, since the idea is to move the needle, as it were, when it comes to issues of climate change? What are we going to do with all of the circa 2034 automobiles that will still be around for a while? One suggestion, serving suggestion. Oh, by the way, just for the sake of your producer and you guys, I'm talking to you through a rotary dial Bakelite telephone, which works. It goes back to the Eisenhower administration, but
tremendous.
It worked.
That's great. Well, we just did a show about FDR. If you can get one a little older than that, you know, call us again. But anyway,
That's a telephone that can double as a murder weapon. But I digress.
Yeah, fair enough.
I've just now a 1947 Alco locomotive just rumbled by my house.
Ah.
That thing will run on algae, which is probably better than bunker fuel when it comes to moving the needle. My point being is, Politically, there's a fellow who moves barges of oil up and down the Mississippi, and he's concerned that he's in the buggy whip business. So this might be a way of solving a couple of problems, I pontificate, before I fall off my soapbox, so that we can basically, since the idea is to move the needle, it would help move the needle.
I see. Ed, you, I think, have an electric car. I think there was something about that in there. Why don't you try to, say something now.
I can tell you that the Department of Transport a couple of years ago in California did a study and discovered that about 3% of the cars on the road at that time were producing 95% of the pollution. So as those cars go off the road, or as we use more salt in California, so they have to go off the road sooner or later, the problem, generally speaking, disappears. The newer cars, for example, I drive a Prius now, it produces so little carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide out of the back of it because of the system it has, that you can't kill yourself if you leave it in your garage running. So we're getting to the point where the car isn't the major problem. The problem is the older cars that are still on the road that are producing the greatest amount of pollution.
And 50% of the NOxes and SOxes, the acids that are created by combustion, are not created by automobiles or transportation at all. They're created by power plants. They're created by your basic large industry that has to create its own power and burn fossil fuels to do that. So it's a multi-pronged approach. I remember reading an article about 5 years ago that in France, in order to eliminate smog mainly, it wasn't a climate change issue, it was more smog, they had compressed air cars that they were selling.
Huh.
And the idea is kind of just like your paper airplane or that rocket that you used to like load up, you'd used to pump the water in and then shoot it off.
Yeah.
The same idea is you put compressed gas in a canister and being air, and then use that as your source of energy to move your car from place to place.
Ah.
So there are other options. You still need a way to compress the gas, and that often doesn't require, but ends up being the cheapest source, which right now is a fossil fuel. But that is a way. You could have only compressed gas cars or vehicles in a city center, and that would cut down on the smog. It wouldn't necessarily fix global warming, but it would be a contributor.
Fair enough. Well, thank you, David, for that that interesting call. Let's go to Sandra in Adams, Massachusetts. Sandra, you're on.
Hi there, folks. So I have sort of a question of semantics about this COVID-19 vaccine. The word vaccine in my head is a permanent protection, such as the smallpox vaccine I had as an infant, or the blessed polio vaccine came along a few years later when I was in elementary school. Those were permanent protections for the rest of my life. But I get a flu shot every year, but that's not permanent. I can still catch the flu, but it would be a milder version. So I'm confused, and I think a lot of my friends are equally confused when we're calling this a vaccine. Is this more akin to the flu shot, or is it more akin to the polio vaccine?
Well, that's a great question, and it's kind of a little bit of each. Let me explain what goes on when you get, you still get polio vaccines. Is that creates an immune response, yeah, which is relatively durable throughout your whole life. And therefore, since polio was mostly an issue for children, for contracting it as a child, it certainly gets you out of your childhood and into your adulthood. I had to, for some reason, as a small child, I needed two rounds of polio vaccine because one was the Sabin and the other was the Sanger. But in order to end up with the correct titer. And in fact, I remember in college, I needed to get a second measles round because my first quote unquote permanent measles round was found to be ineffective. So it does take a longer study to figure out how long these vaccines last. As you know, you need a tetanus booster every 10 years. That's a vaccine.
Right.
What happens with the flu vaccine, however, is flu is a highly evolving virus. And so the flu vaccine you might get in 2012 is not the same flu vaccine that you would get in 2020. Because what flu is the one running around the planet is not the same as it was in 2012. You still have some immunity from whatever you were vaccinated with in 2012. It's just that that flu has kind of run its course. Now it's on to the next version. What we're seeing with COVID-19 is it's not as evolving as the flu or the common cold, for example. It is less evolving, but it is mutating because of the sheer severity of the infections, the number of people who have it. So every time the virus is transferred, there's a chance for a mutation. And that mutation rate is relatively low compared to, say, influenza or the cold. So we will probably need to be vaccinated again. What we don't know is how long. Will it be every 10 years like we do with tetanus? Will it be every 2 years? We don't really know because we don't yet have any idea other than guessing how well these COVID vaccines will do to train our immune system to recognize coronavirus in the future.
Very interesting.
It is, after all. The coronaviruses have not been targets of vaccines because it's been tough, but we kind of stood on the shoulders of scientists before us who were working on coronavirus vaccines and able to whip this thing out in 9 months. So
Barbara,
time will tell.
Barbara Brabets is here and Ed Stender as well. It's the Science Forum. We'll take a quick break. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Science Forum on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Barbara Brabets and Ed Stander here from SUNY Cobleskill answering your science questions. Elizabeth in Albany writes, I had a tiny chip in my windshield, but it got really cold last night, and lo and behold, that tiny chip has become a huge crack all the way across the windshield. Why does temperature change make glass behave this way?
That's called a Griffith crack. And the crack was actually first described by a guy named Griffith who was trying to figure out why milk bottles would suddenly blow up during cold nights. And what happens is that the crack has a very, very sharp point on it. And that point between where there's a crack and there's no crack on the other side of it, is a area of very, very, very high stress. And it just takes a little bit of opening of that crack to cause it to start to shoot further. And once it starts shooting, there's almost nothing to stop it. So it's a very, very common occurrence. And it's one of the reasons why if you even get a small chip in your window, it's probably a good idea to have it changed.
All right.
They will take off.
This one is from Jennifer in Hoosick Falls. Jennifer writes, I've noticed that silicone has become very popular in recent years with cooking utensils. It lines the bottom of mixing bowls. It's used for spatulas. You can even get silicone cake molds, but they don't always label if the silicone is heat safe. Is all silicone heat safe, or might it melt if I put the wrong silicone thing in the oven?
If you are not baking a pizza, you're pretty well safe. Silicone is good to about 400 Fahrenheit. You can make higher temperature silicones and then medium temperature silicones. But if it's a food product, if it's sold as a food product, the FDA would have had to evaluate it for general use. So you don't have any worry about the silicone coming off into your food product. But about 350, 400 is the max unless it's labeled otherwise.
All right, this one is from Mark. And Mark says, I live in a rural area that has a problem with bats. Aside from the obvious fear of getting bitten, are there other dangers associated with proximity to bats? For example, from exposure to the urine or fecal matter. And what's the best way to get rid of them if they should ever get into your home? And that is from Mark.
Well, Mark, I'm the person who doesn't think bats are a problem. Send them my way.
Hang on, Barb. You have bats flying around your house, and you're okay with that?
Not inside,
okay,
no.
Well,
certainly outside. I tell you, I bought one of those Skeeter Vacs years ago, which was marketed as a way to cut down on mosquitoes so that you didn't have to use insecticides. And I have about a two-acre area around my house that I did not want to have to spray for bugs, but at the same time, I wanted to be able to use it and not, like, sit inside and watch from the outside. The mosquitoes were fierce.
Yeah.
So I bought this Skeeter Vac, and it did okay. You burn propane, and propane puts out a little CO2, and the bugs come and get sucked up. And I think more of it is mental, that I was like, that Skeeter Vac is getting them all. But in reality, I was still spraying myself. I was still, you know, covered in bug spray every time I went out. What I did instead is I went out and I got several bat-friendly appliances. So I've got a big bat box. My husband gave it to me for my birthday one year. And then they can live there and also behind the shutters of my house, come out at night, and they eat, I think it's something like 5 times their weight a day in bugs. It's just amazing. And they're pesticide-free. I have had one bat in the house in 15 years, and I just turned off all the lights, opened all the windows, and I went away. And when I came back home, he was gone.
No, interesting.
But I would recommend that if you do have a bat in the house and it's difficult for you to do something like if you do what I do and it didn't work, then you call in a professional, because they are rabies vectors, and the bats tend to be not smart when they have rabies. So if you see a bat acting dumb, assume it's rabid and call the professionals in.
Fair enough. This one is from Pete, and then we'll get back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Pete writes, and the subject heading is interesting, math as a tool of science, ? Pete says, please comment on the relationship between science and math. As an educator myself, I've noticed that most students do not like math class. I've suspected it may have to do perhaps with the practice of separating math from science. In other words, if math was taught in the context of science instead of separating it, might it seem more relevant and therefore appeal to more students? What do you think? And that's from Pete.
Well, I would.
And you want to take
agree.
That one? Because I think we have this discussion all the time with our students.
Yeah, well, basically, math is math, but applied math is learning. It's critical thinking and it's education. And when you're in a situation where you are just effectively learning to do math, it can get pretty dry. But if you give a problem where you're trying to solve something, or you go out and you get enough information to make sense out of it, then math becomes interesting. I'm fully involved with trying to get people to do math through science, because it's certainly a much, much easier way to learn.
Barbara, you agree?
Another way, yeah, I agree to a certain extent, although my math colleagues will say, come on, you're not giving math fair shrift. But I think of math and its application in science, similarly the way I think of how we teach English grammar as a, here is a preposition, here is a gerund, and we kind of deconstruct a sentence. And then the application of grammar being, say, like debate. One has much more of an applied field than the other, and therefore has an interest put there by its user, as opposed to someone denoting whether it's a preposition or a conjunction or a noun.
You know,
that's how I think we teach math, and I do think it's a shame.
You know, one thing that I've read, and I got to tell you, I'm in radio for a reason. Math is not my strong suit. Although, if you want me to back time a Buckingham single to the top of the hour, I'm good with that. But, you know, I've heard that those who are really immersed in numbers and in math, they say there is a beauty to it. And I can't figure out exactly what they mean.
Oh, I see it. I took 3 semesters of calculus. I mean, like three semesters to get through one calculus. I took up through Calc 3. And Calc 1 I got, Calc 2 I didn't. And Calc 3 showed me the beauty of calculus and how I could solve things instead of the kind of crutch way that we do with algebra, how we could do it so beautifully with calculus. And it's almost a simplicity. It's kind of like when you get into the part of the Sudoku where you've got like 2 boxes left and then the 4 must go here and then the 2 must go here and the 9 must go here. Oh my gosh, it's falling into place. Everything's chink, 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 chink. Well, that's what it feels like when math has that kind of beautiful simplicity. And often it does if you're doing it right.
Ed.
Science is exactly the same way. And that's what the joy of doing math and science is. Is that when you have a problem and you can't solve it, and suddenly you start coming up with an equation that makes sense, and you can use that to predict what's coming next, that's the beauty of the whole thing.
It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. Barbara Brabets and Ed Standard join us from SUNY Cobleskill. The number is 800-348-2551. And we go to Evie in Gloversville. Hello there, Evie.
Hi, Ray. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm Jim's wife. He just told about the TV.
Yeah.
So we're in the car. We're in the car going to Massachusetts. The question is, could increased methane levels uncovered beneath the melting ice in the Arctic cause severe change in the Earth's atmosphere?
Okay.
Yeah, well,
I think she wants more than yes as an answer.
Well, the answer is yes. Effectively, there is so much methane on the Earth right now in various locations that if it were all to melt, the Earth would be sort of like Venus, where the temperature of the atmosphere would be on the order of 500 or 600 degrees. There's gigatons, I tell you, of methane at the bottom of the oceans. And if the oceans start to warm up and that stuff gets out, we're in big trouble. And any place there's bacteria and it's cold, the methane winds up getting trapped. And when the temperature goes up and the methane starts to get out, being a very good climate changer, it can have an enormous effect on the atmosphere.
All right.
And there's a magnifier, too. Even the conversion of CO2 to methane is pretty much run by bacteria. If bacteria are in the tundra or the peat mosses of the highlands of Scotland and they're nice and cold, they're only reproducing so fast. But if they're warmed up just by a few degrees of temperature, then they get into a zone of temperature where they can very quickly reproduce and therefore convert stuff to methane. So we can take it from a locked stage to an unlocked stage. And, of course, methane is 55 times more greenhouse warming than CO2. So one molecule of methane versus one molecule of CO2 is a lot bigger bang.
And if I can continue, when the methane gets into the atmosphere and it starts to break down, then it breaks down to carbon dioxide and oxygen. It takes the oxygen out of the atmosphere to produce carbon dioxide and water. And so if enough methane gets into the atmosphere, then all of a sudden the amount of oxygen we have to breathe is going to start dropping. And that would not be a good thing for us.
Which extinction event was probably methane driven?
probably the Permian extinction, where about 85% of life on Earth disappeared, and it was probably caused by this ice at the bottom of the ocean getting into the atmosphere and dropping the oxygen levels to the point where everybody was living at about 15,000 feet.
Mm. And how long ago was that?
That was about 250 million years ago. So we're okay for the moment.
Fair enough. Let's go to Roger in Lanesboro. Hello, Roger.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. I know it's not my
last
form. Hey, Bob. I couldn't resist the math comment. I wanted to give you an engineer's perspective.
Okay.
Math is a beautiful language. It's a beautiful language. And, you know, as engineers, we have to apply science as we see trends in science and things in science. And what math does is it allows us to model predictively what scientific phenomena will do. So, you know, we can take scientific phenomena and we can now use math to be predictive about what it will do and then apply those scientific principles. So think of it as a beautiful language.
I still can't wrap my head around the beauty.
Did you hear, Roger, the question about the thumping television when it's off?
Yeah, and I think there's two things. One, you guys were talking about it, capacitors can retain charges. That's always been the case.
Yeah.
But if he's using an older style TV with a CRT, okay, the cathode ray tube actually will act as a capacitor it'll retain a charge because of the way the CRT is designed. It's got two plates between it, and it'll actually retain a charge like a capacitor. And a CRT will retain a charge for days. I used to work in the TV repair business when we fixed TVs, and you always discharge the CRT before you worked on it.
But you wouldn't get a thumping out of that, would you? You'd just get a sudden a discharge at the end.
Say that again? I'm sorry?
I'm just wondering, would you get a thumping sound? Because that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, he said there was a thumping sound in his TV, even if it wasn't on, as long as it was plugged in.
Well, it's probably the neighbor thumping.
You know, that's not helpful, Roger.
Somebody's leaving in the TV.
Yeah. Hey, man, thanks for calling into the program.
Thanks. Great to listen.
All right, buddy. We'll talk to you soon. Let's get another one in here before we wrap up. Oh, this is a good one. Lisa in Warwick. Lisa, you're on.
Hi there. I'm a high school math teacher in Warwick, so I also couldn't resist the comment about having trouble seeing the beauty in math. I want to say a couple things. First of all, my favorite college professor, Ed Berger, used to give a talk that said he would say why he loved art museums and hated math, even though he was a math professor. And it's because anyone can walk into an art museum and appreciate something and see how beautiful things are. But it's very challenging. It can be very challenging to appreciate the beauty in math if you're just, you know, a regular guy who walks in and looks around. Sometimes it can be challenging. So I wanted to make that point. But also, I'm pure math. I'm not applied math. So I don't actually have a lot of the science applications that you guys do. But one of the things I love about math is that a lot of math is developed kind of in a vacuum, not knowing how it's going to be able to be applied. And then much of it turns out to be applied wonderfully. And I think that's one of the most amazing things about it, is that it relates to things even without people realizing ahead of time that it will relate to things.
Ed, you want to comment
those
on that?
Those are great comments.
Oh, Barb, go ahead.
I would just say that in pure math, and let me give you an anecdote that reinforces what the last two callers have said. When you go to a conference, a chemistry conference, for example, and you present new material, it's vetted to the audience that has the capacity to know whether it's crap or not. I mean, there's not just two piles, crap and no crap. There's, you know, various degrees of it. But what will happen is if you put up an equation to describe a phenomenon and the equation has multiple terms, meaning something plus something divided by something plus something, and that number of terms is absurd, let me say more than five, what you're going to get from the audience is disdain and scorn, because we've all been programmed through repetition to understand that math has a beauty and nature has a beauty that can be described.
And if you need multiple factors to fudge the numbers to get it to meet your natural phenomenon, then you're coming at it with the wrong approach.
Hmm.
So as the math teacher from Warwick said, there are fields of math that were created. I'm thinking like Bayesian theory that were created before there wasn't a use for them. And then later on, we use Bayesian theory to help with computer programming and artificial intelligence. And it's like art in that it's beauty. It's amazing that something can be created out of nothing.
Well,
and that's math.
You know what? That's a great way to wrap up the program. I apologize to Fred in Ware, Massachusetts, who wanted to know what counts for the uniform shape of chicken eggs. That'll be next time. Ed Stander and Barbara Brabets, thanks for being here on the show today.
You're welcome.
We'll talk to you soon. Support comes from Watercolors by Edith Shutesbury. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic on watercolors, paintings of people and pets from emailed photographs, no contact required. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And Penny Farthing, socially responsible investment management of personal retirement and endowment portfolios, Amherst, PennyFarthingInvestment.com. Eric Bright, CFA. Once again, thanks to Barb and Ed for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls and the emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, Jackie Orchard, our producer. Wes Burton took the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the Food Friday program, Holly Shelowitz will talk about immune-boosting foods. That's a two right now. Stand by for the Capital Connection.